and to the strains of great Bay Area guitarist Pepino D'Agostino, and welcome you to another edition of Open Air, normally hosted by David LaTulipe. My name is Kevin Vance, sitting in for him today. We're going to talk about a great performance of a great production of Death of a Salesman going on the peninsula. Also, Irving Berlin is going to be brought back to the living. We'll hear more about that. Peter Robinson is here to tell us about things literary and things Louis Armstrong and things Noel Coward. We just happen to have in the neighborhood doing a little bit of work, radio work, and coming to San Francisco, and I thought I'd ask him to sit in with us for about 12 minutes, a voice that we all kind of grew up with. Bob Edwards, former host of Morning Edition and now host of a program on Sirius XM. What's the name of the program?
Well, until recently, I was the host of The Bob Edwards Show on Sirius XM.
That should be easy for me to remember.
And Bob Edwards Weekend, which was distributed by Public Radio International. So I was in both the satellite world and the public radio world.
Good.
Until September.
What happened?
What happened is now I'm launching a podcast, which seems to be the way of the future.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking my chances there and have so many ideas that we really don't have the focus yet of what it's going to be, because there's so many possibilities. I can go this direction and that direction. I'm here in San Francisco to attend a TEDx program at San Quentin.
Mm. What's going on there?
Well, there are people incarcerated there, you might have heard. And
I know about that place. I know that place well. I drive by it a lot.
There are prisoners who are going to give TED Talks, and there are other people interested in prison reform. Not enough, but they'll be giving TED Talks too. And so prison reform is one subject we want to explore. Another is music. And I did an interview last night with Paul Thorne, who's appearing. He was in Petaluma.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing musicians. This part of the program we're calling Backstage with Bob.
Mm.
Another area of interest, which I'm not permitted to announce, but may involve the centennial of the National Park Service. Mm-hmm. So visiting national parks is something that interests me, and hopefully online radio listeners.
I think taking a hike in the woods on the radio is a great idea.
We're also talking about something more serious. I did an interview today at the Golden Gate Bridge with Kevin Briggs, who's a former California Highway Patrolman whose job it was to talk people off of the bridge who wanted to end their lives. So we're doing a lot about suicide and suicide prevention. He's retired from the CHP, but now has his own company and is involved in suicide prevention that way. So there's at least four subjects that we're launching at, and we'll find out if we can add more or subtract some and be more focused. I don't know. It's such a exciting world that anything is possible. So
there's no shortage of things to ask and people to talk
to. Well, that's the point. You know, what are we, whether we're in radio or online or wherever? We're storytellers. And that's what I'm interested in doing and continuing doing. It's what I've been doing for 48 years. So there are plenty more stories to tell. And I think I can still tell them.
Where do you start collecting stories? In the newsroom, in the radio studio, in the
newspaper? We don't have a studio anymore. Wherever you can go with a microphone.
That's right. Anywhere with a microphone can be called a studio.
Well,
now.
Today I was on a bridge, so there's a studio.
A great, beautiful outdoors there. Bob Edwards here in the KLW studio for just a few minutes. You got a busy day. You've been doing some interviews here in the studio. And then where are you off to after this?
Back home to put it together. We're going to the Manassas Battlefield National Park. So that might give you a hint of that, you know, what I'm not at liberty to discuss. Project.
We won't tell a soul. We won't tell. It's public radio. You know, you're amongst friends.
Yeah, but that's the next chapter. So we'll focus on parks for a time and continue to interview musicians as they pass through Washington, D.C., which is where we all live. I say we. Chad Campbell, my producer, is here. We work together at NPR and at Sirius XM satellite radio.
So. You don't do this by yourself. You have a whole...
Oh, would that I could, but...
Yeah.
No. I need...
Some of us radio people know how to do these things by ourselves, but...
Well, you know, I broke into radio at a time when you had plenty of helpers.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's one person with his own audio equipment and running his own board and everything. So fortunately, I still have Chad.
Mm. That's good. Producers are the great unsung heroes in radio. So where did it start for you? Was it the newsroom?
Where? What do you mean start?
Where did
1968?
Yeah. So when did you know that you were a storyteller?
Oh, I wanted to be in radio from the time I was three or four. Mm. I knew I was going to be in radio.
What did you listen to that you said, I want to be like that?
Oh, with everything. As a little kid, they still had old-time radio, you know, because I was born in 1947. Mm-hmm. You still had the Lone Ranger on the radio, the Shadow, Ozzie and Harriet, I heard for the first time on the radio, not on television. And I wanted to be a voice in the box, which is what I titled my memoir.
Oh, you have a memoir, yes.
I listened to Edward R. Murrow. He was my hero, even though as a kid I didn't have any idea what he was talking about. He was talking about serious stuff, and people were listening to him, and he had great gravitas. And so I wanted to be that person, and Walter Cronkite. Now you have to explain to young people who Walter Cronkite was.
Yeah, I understand. and only a new generation knows who Edward R. Murrow is from the movie Good Night and Good Luck.
They could get my book.
Yeah. But tell me about your book. Tell me about the memoirs.
Edward R. Murrow and the Birth of Broadcast Journalism.
I know that book. It's a fantastic.
He's our granddaddy. He's the one who really established news on both radio and then later television. The real pioneer who put together that fabulous World War II reporting team in Europe. I mean, before then you had coverage of, you know, the Scopes trial and, you know, the Lindbergh kidnapping trial. You had news conferences and special events, but you didn't have daily in-depth news coverage until World War II and the Murrow team, and on television until See It Now.
That's right. That's right. I'm a little past that generation, but my introduction to Edward R. Murrow was the I Can Hear It Now records.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the records, which preceded even the radio show before television.
Yeah. So Edward R. Murrow was one of your heroes. And then from where was the first radio gig?
In 1968, in New Albany, Indiana, which is right across the river from Louisville, Kentucky, which is where I was born and raised. So, you know, I wasn't, as a rookie, worthy of breaking into that big market of Louisville. Mm-hmm. Had to start in New Albany, Indiana, as a DJ on a elevator music station, the world's most beautiful music.
Oh, wow.
And did the news, did rip and read, but I would go out and do stories, too, because I wanted more than that. So I don't think they had ever gone out and covered stories before.
You want to go out and get a news story? What do you think this is, a newspaper?
The station was so bad, ABC dropped us as an affiliate.
Whoa, that's bad. That's awful.
And then there was the month we also could not afford the UPI machine, so there went our rip and read. So we were reading the Louisville Courier-Journal. And
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. What were the call letters?
W-H-E-L.
I'll bet it was.
Oh, later on, it became a gospel station, and they changed the call letters.
They better have, honestly. Oh, interesting to hear the Louisville.
I had a window in front of me, and there was no insulation, so the Belle of Louisville steamboat would come down the Ohio River, and you trucks would go into second gear right in front of the studio. So that was great.
My grandma lived in Louisville, and my dad was born in Harlan County, and she lived in Jeffersonville, Indiana, on the other side of the Ohio River.
My brother lives there. That's right next door to New Albany.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So what happened with you and NPR? We heard you for so many years on Morning Edition, and then all of a sudden you weren't there anymore.
It's broadcasting, and broadcasting, they decide you've had enough, and they want to make a change. And that's the only thing I can figure, because I didn't do anything wrong. We were the number one program in all of public radio. We had 13 million daily listeners. Everything was fine, but managers decide they want somebody else. And they want you to do something else, so I was reassigned to senior correspondent. And that was all right. The reassignment was fine. But then people were outraged, and they got 50,000 emails protesting, and petitions were flying, and horrible things were being said about the managers at NPR, and they got mad, and they couldn't explain it to the satisfaction of listeners. They would say, meeting the changing needs of our audience, and the audience was saying, we don't need any changes. So they started saying bad things about me. They had to knock me down and say he wasn't this, he wasn't that. And that's when I got angry. And so I left them. I love NPR. I love it to this day. But you know, my wife works there. Windsor Johnston is here with me and came to San Francisco with me. On the California Zephyr, by the way.
Oh, yay. Oh. On Amtrak. Isn't it gorgeous?
Yes. Loved it, loved it, loved it.
Oh.
So I'm totally supportive of NPR and wish them well, and that's the end of that.
but now you're erstwhile at Sirius XM now.
No,
you're still
that's
doing,
over now.
That is over now.
Podcast now.
Podcast.
That's it. The new era of Bob.
Are we getting too old for this medium? Is this medium getting too old for
us? Go to BobEdwardsRadio.com and you'll find out all about it.
No, the answer is no. Go to BobEdwardsRadio.com. That's fantastic, because I mean, I thought everybody had Sirius XM, but I'm still driving a car with a cassette player in it.
It's pretty successful. I mean, it's 25 million subscribers. That's a lot. You know, that's, I think I was a success at both of those places, and it bodes well for this third chapter, and I'll be successful there.
Bob, what an honor to have you here in the KLW studio.
Thank you for asking.
You're welcome, and best of luck. And what advice do you have for the aspiring radio person, journalist or disc jockey?
Listen, be a good listener, and you'll be a good interviewer. And writing. Writing is the most important thing because we're telling a story, and it has to be clear and concise, and the listener has to absorb it without distractions of bad writing.
Keep writing and write again.
Yeah.
And I like the part about listen. That's what I try and do myself. Bob, thank you. An honor to meet you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Bob Edwards here in the KLW studio here on Open Air. A little bit of music and we go on to our next. We're going to be talking about Bach and a new transcription of the Toccata and Fugue for violin and Death of a Salesman and Irving Berlin and Noel Coward here on Open Air. version of Blue Skies Shining on Me. That song is going to run through your head all afternoon, but that's okay. It's Open Air. I'm Kevin Vance sitting in for David LaTulipe. I want to introduce to the KLW microphone a young lady named Tatiana, and I'm only calling her that because I'm too chicken to ask her how to pronounce her last name. But I will. Would you just yell out how to say your last name? Chulochnikova. And what she has is this beautiful violin poised, and she's going to give us a quick little performance of a piece that we all associate with the organ. We all, maybe some of you may associate it with Sunday morning services, or maybe you may think of vampires rising out of coffins. This is the Toccata and Fugue in, is it B minor?
What? Originally in D minor.
It was originally in D minor. And you
transposed
it to A minor. So BWV 565 that I remember. So without any further ado, I would love to hear what you've done with it on the violin. After that was beautiful. Would you pull up a chair and sit at the microphone here? Her name is Tatiana, her last name, and forgive me for not practicing it in advance. Chulochnikova. She's nodding her head, so I said it right, albeit slowly and with that awful American accent that I have. So what inspired you? That was your creation, that you were able to transpose that organ piece into a violin piece. Tell me the story of that.
Well, everyone wants to play this piece. And even if you don't play organ, you kind of dream to be able to play it anyway. So, and I was introduced to a version by another great violinist, Jaap Schroeder, who made his own version of it. And I started learning it, and I loved it a lot, but I just wanted to change some things. So this is how my own version emerged. I really tried to get as close as possible to the original score. I did have the organ score in front of me when I was doing the transcription. Of course, some things had to be compromised in order to fit for the violin, right? So, the harmonies, the original text, I really tried to keep the original.
I heard that, and in fact, in some of those places where I imagine the organ player is using his or her full hands and legs,
of course,
to create the chord, and there
and
you
we
are
only
doing
have four strings and two
you
hands,
only
yeah.
have four strings and a few fingers and one bow, yeah. and that's it. But you did some. I saw what you were doing, and I heard what you were doing. That was fantastic. Have you done that before? Have you taken other instruments, other works for other instruments?
No, this is my first experience. In fact, no, there was. No need. There's so much to play for violin, actually. And never had to transpose anything. There's so much original repertoire for violin.
Oh, absolutely.
But this piece is very special. I really wanted to play it, to be able to play it on my instrument. So that was the idea.
Tatiana is going to be giving this performance. It's part of the American, along with members of the American Bach Soloists. The dates that I have here are Friday, tomorrow, the 22nd of January, at 8 p.m. at St. Stephen's Church in Belvedere. Sunday the 23rd at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley. Sunday the 24th, an afternoon show at 4 p.m. at St. Mark's Lutheran Church here in San Francisco. And for listeners near Sacramento, Monday the 25th at 7 p.m. at the Davis Community Center in Davis. Was it your idea to do that, to do the transposition there, or did somebody say, I'm going to assign you to do this?
No, it was entirely my idea. Initiative.
That's fantastic. And then, so you did that, and then did American Bach Soloists approach you, or did you approach them and say, I want to do this?
Well, at the time, I was already a member of the group, luckily, and I just shared with Maestro Jeffrey Thomas that mm-hmm. This is one of my recent projects. And he was interested to include it to the first time I played it was over a year ago at the Gala performance. Mm. Also here in Belvedere. And this was the first time I ever played it, and the audience seemed to enjoy it a lot, so they decided to program it this January in one of the subscription concerts. So I'm very happy to play it second time. It's always fun to be able to revisit these pieces and to play it more than once.
What an absolute treat. And will you be playing it solo, or will you be playing it with the orchestra?
No, this is a solo violin transcription.
That is
so
solo.
This piece will be performed by myself. And then also another piece that's programmed that evening is an E major concerto by Bach.
Mm, okay. Yeah. And so the rest of the evening you will be on stage just being one of the guys.
No, I will be soloing.
I will be soloing. You'll
yeah.
be soloing.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's fantastic. Tatiana with the American Bach Soloists. Again, the events are happening. There's going to be the Toccata and Fugue in D minor and selections from various cantatas, motets of Bach, and the violin concerto in E major will be performed at these performances. And the website that I'm looking at for more information and tickets is AmericanBach.org, the website for the American Bach Soloists. How long have you been with them?
Well, we met first at the very first year of the academy that they have. It's a summer school. It's a wonderful early music workshop that happens every summer in San Francisco. And this is how we all met. Mm. 5 years ago, in 2010, I came as one of the students to the academy, and this is how we knew each other originally. But then I was honored to be invited to perform with them several times as a member of the group, and then this year, I'm soloing with them, so it's a big honor for me.
I always ask this. When did you pick up a violin and say, I want to do this, I want to play this?
Well, those were two different ages, in fact. I picked it up at 7, which mm-hmm. was considered pretty late. But when I actually decided that I'm going to do it professionally, it was probably I was probably 16, yeah. Kids don't like to practice. No one likes to practice. So I was only doing it because my parents wanted me. But then it turned out to be something I chose as my professional path. So quite surprising for everyone, for myself and for my parents who are not musicians.
Was there a piece that turned you on? Was there a particular
composer's work? Probably, but I just remember that at the time then when it was time to choose, your major in college and everything. So I just asked myself, so what is it I want to do? And it turned out that music is what I'm interested in most of all. So this is how I ended up being a professional musician.
Mm-hmm. And you're able to do this every day and get paid for it.
Exactly. This is a luxury.
Fantastic. Yeah. You're very lucky. And I think we're very lucky to have American Box Soloists.
Oh, I think we are. Yes, yeah. Indeed.
Again, I'll tell you where the events are. Friday the 22nd, that's tomorrow evening at 8 p.m. at St. Stephen's Church in Belvedere. Saturday the 23rd, day after tomorrow at First Congregational Church in Berkeley. Sunday, an afternoon performance at 4 p.m. at St. Mark's Lutheran Church here in San Francisco. And then Monday the 25th at the Davis Community Center in Davis, not far from the city of Sacramento and the university there. American Bach Soloists, their website is americanbach.org. Tatiana, thank you so much.
Thank you very
much. An honor to hear the performance and have a fantastic show.
Thank you so much for giving me a chance to share this with you. Thank you.
Putting on the Ritz, there's the other song that I want to have running through your head for the rest of the week. It's the open air program normally hosted by David LaTulipe, and I'm Kevin Vance sitting in for him this week. I'm pleased to welcome back to the KLW studio an old friend, Diane Keough, a regular contributor to this program. She was going to get us all excited about a couple of events going on the peninsula where she's currently living these days. So there's Death of a Salesman and there's a Irving Berlin thing.
And yes, and wonderful. Wait a minute. And I just wanted to mention a couple of other things in the artistic vein. At the Peninsula Museum of Art, they have two particular artists showing until April 10th. One of them is Salma Aristu, The Celebration of Calligraphy, which an awful lot of it is done in Arabic and beautiful colors. See that, Kevin? I can't show the audience, but you see what I mean.
It is gorgeous. It looks like a really beautiful Jackson Pollock there.
Yes, it does to quite a degree. And the other one is Tim Berry, who uses oil and mixed media on paper. And he's going to be there until April 10th, and that's at the Peninsula Museum of Art. And it's in Burlingame, and it's open from Tuesday through Sunday. I seem to have a frog that I can't get rid of.
I know. There's a lot of frogs going around here. Frogs and all sorts of amphibians.
I used to collect them, but I didn't want to collect one in my throat. So anyway, yeah, let's go along with we've got people on the line.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
The Death of a Salesman is happening, and my ears perked up when you told me about this Death of a Salesman project. I was in Death of a Salesman at Laney College many years ago. I auditioned for about 4 parts in that, and I wound up being the light person, but I knew all the lines and all the parts.
Well, it's a very heavy, heavy show as far as conversation goes. You can't miss a line because every word has a meaning in this show.
It does. We're happy to have welcome to the telephone Tim Farrell, who plays the part of Willie Loman. Tim, good afternoon. We want to welcome to the telephone Tim Farrell, who plays Willie Loman in this production of Death of a Salesman. Tim, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And Kristen Lowe is also on the telephone. She is the director of this production of Death of a Salesman. Good afternoon, Kristen.
Good afternoon.
Excellent.
And I want to let everybody know this is Palo Alto Players, and this is, I believe, their 85th year. Now, that's a long time for a small organization to be around, and every year it gets better and better. Now, you probably heard of Lucy Stern Theater out on...
I have heard of Lucy Stern Theater.
It was built for Palo Alto Players.
No kidding.
Yeah, I didn't know that either, but that's quite interesting because Theater Works uses it a lot, as do many other things, but it's a perfect theater for them. Anyway, I want to let you go and talk to them for a while, and I'll just jump in.
Okay, fantastic. Tim Farrell, I knew the play inside and out, I want to ask, is the line walrus or shrimp for you?
It's walrus.
It's walrus, yeah. Because I understand that one of the first actors to play Willie Loman was not a person of huge stature, and so the line was shrimp. when they cast one of the first productions of it, he was not a shrimp, so they made him a walrus.
But. Oh, that's funny. And of course, the line preceding it is he says I'm to his wife, "I'm fat, I'm foolish to look at." I'm not particularly fat, but we're going with that anyway. So.
Death of a Salesman is, for the two or three people who don't know what it is, it's this beautiful tragedy, I like to call it. It's about modern America, middle class, a man who works very, very hard, loves his job, but somehow the world seems to be going by him, and for some reason he's not able to catch up, and that world that's going by him doesn't seem to care, no matter how much heart he has into it. Do I have that right? Does that sound right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. The world has passed. Well, you know, to begin with, he's never been very good as a salesman. I mean, that's important to note. But he committed to that. It was his holy grail. I don't know if you remember the long monologue, and I obviously did the whole thing. But he tells us that at the age of 18 or 19, he decided selling was the greatest career a man could want. And then he committed himself to that, and he worked at it for 34 years, 10, 12 hours a day, as he tells his wife, and stuck with it. That takes a lot of courage, I think.
I would imagine so, and must have been some kind of reward to it. And the other interesting thing is we never find out what he actually sells. We just know
right.
that he carries around a valise with samples in it, and that's all we know.
That's right, the nylons, right.
And without creating any spoiler alerts, of course, the implication of the name of the movie of the play is The Death of a Salesman. The question is, what do we learn from this when we're watching this tragic figure and his relationships with his family and his relationships with his neighbor and his employer? What do we come away with this? Do we feel that what a poor fellow this guy is, or is it a bigger indictment of society and that seems to leave people behind? Or what do you think people are going to walk away with when they see this, whether they see it for the millionth time or
yeah.
the first time?
Wow, I'm glad this is a three-hour show.
you got plenty of time.
Let's see where to start. Well, you know what? For one thing, I hope Miller wrote a wonderful piece for the New York Times, just I think about the time the play came out, called Tragedy and the Common Man. And he argues in that most people have a misunderstanding of tragedy, that rightly looked at, it is more optimistic than comedy, because it reaffirms the finest in what human beings can be. I think he uses the phrase the indomitability of the human spirit. So one thing I hope people take away is admiration for a man. first of all, a man very hard to like in a lot of ways. And as I've said so many times, I used to challenge my students when I taught the play. The very first thing I would say is, you don't have to like Willie Loman, but you got to care about him. And so I hope people can walk away appreciating a man who refuses to give up his dream, refuses to give in to all the things working against him. When his son tells him in the final act, and maybe a spoiler alert, maybe I hope not, face it, Pop, I'm a dime a dozen, and so are you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great and terrible line.
And Willie says in the stage directions, in uncontrolled outburst, Willie says, I am not a dime a dozen. I am Willie Loman. And when this play works, when it's worked for me over the years, there's something heroic in that moment in Willie, for all of his faults, for all of his flaws. Can I keep talking?
I
hope the audience...
Go ahead, one more point, and then I'll ask a Christian something.
Great. Well, just the other thing, of course, the other thing why this play is so relevant to high school students, why we taught it for so many years, and to their parents as well, is Biff's most important line in the play, I think, is the son, when he says, I don't know what I'm supposed to want. I don't know what I want, I don't know what I'm supposed to want. And the play brings all kinds of questions about parenting styles, supposed to according to whom? His parents, his father, certainly, society at large. So to young people on the cusp of making, you know, life-determining decisions, 18, 17, 18-year-olds, boy, this play speaks a lot about pursuing your own dream rather than someone else's. And I'll give Kristen a chance to talk.
We're talking with Tim Farrell. He plays the part of Willie Loman in this Palo Alto Players production of Death of a Salesman. Kristen Lowe is the director, and she's also on the telephone. I understand you also play the part of Miss Forsythe in this, too.
I do.
Miss Forsythe being somebody who Willie meets somewhere along the way.
Yeah, she more interacts with Biff and Happy.
That's right.
And she's kind of there to show that the boys in their day, they kind of could catch any girl they wanted, and that's kind of her role in the play. So it's a cameo, but it's really fun to have directed and then also be able to be on stage and kind of continue the fun after opening.
The play takes place in the... Arthur Miller wrote the play in the late 1940s, and a lot of times we associate this play with the architecture looked like, the upstairs, the downstairs, and the great old automobiles that people... I still have a memory of my father's 48. He had two automobiles that were built in 1948. When we are looking at the set and the stage, are we seeing a snapshot into 1948, or are you doing something different with it?
The play is, we're still keeping it in, 1949, and then there are flashbacks to 1932. Mm-hmm. There's the set is very, Jani Cote did the set, and it's very hollow, and it's kind of almost a skeleton of a house. But there are a few things on stage that we did have to pay attention to. The refrigerator is not a modern refrigerator. It's a refrigerator you would find in the 1930s, 1940s, and also the telephone. And besides those things, the costumes and everything, you'll feel like you are looking into 1949.
So you did get a Norga. You did get a...
Yeah, it's one of those short, fat, white refrigerators with kind of the metal handle that pulls up. It actually, it's never opened, but it's on stage, and it does add a lot, I think, to the time period.
Mm.
I have a question I'd like to ask, and it might be just me, but I got the feeling that Willie was an early Alzheimer's man.
Good point.
I wondered if that was part of the thing that he had when he wrote it, or if Alzheimer's had... I mean, nobody talked about it back then, but I got the feeling that poor Willie had a really serious oncoming Alzheimer's.
I think we play it more like he had a life of 30-something years of disappointment and being a failure. it's making him go a little crazy at the end. But I have had lots of audience members come up to me and say, so what is his problem? Is he... schizophrenic? Is, he bipolar? They try to label what they think Willie Loman is. But I think You know, Linda in the play says you can tell what the man's, the problem is, he's exhausted. Just coming to the end of this life and realizing that everything he's done, he's failed at, but he has kept going and kept going, which is one of the attributes where I think people love Willie Loman and can watch him the whole time, because he just does not give up.
When I was doing the production of this in college, people asked if he was alcoholic, and the director said, no, it's not alcoholic. It was more or less what you said. It's like the man has had a hard life, and it's
yeah.
and it's biting him back, and it's finally coming back to haunt him. Are we seeing in Death of a Salesman what a lot of us reaching a certain age are seeing, feeling like the world is leaving us behind, or that we need to catch up? Is that another lesson you think? Besides, I love this hearing that it's giving teenagers and 20-somethings an idea. Is this the right choice you want to do for the rest of your life? But what about all of us who've gone to the other, who are heading towards the other side, in age and life, and going, wait a second, I don't remember life being like this. Wait a second, and isn't that what we're watching Willie going through?
You know, I mean, one of the reasons that we thought we could put this play on is because it's so timeless. When we look at the Bay Area, what's happening to the middle class now, what's happening to property prices, like how does a middle class person survive in the Bay Area with how expenses are going? And so I think you're right that a lot of people do look at the play and they kind of feel like, wow, am I being left behind? Like the American dream promised me something and now it's not cashing in on that promise to me. And then, of course, what Tim Farrell said about, you know, kids of like, what am I supposed to want? And you see two different parenting styles in the play of kind of the helicopter parent, where Willie
yes.
Loman is very involved with his sons, and then his neighbor Charlie, not so much. And so that's very much Palo Alto as well. As I have two boys, and I'm very involved in their lives. You know, so I think when people see the play, they can connect with it in those ways too. That even though it's back in 1949, like some things are not changed.
The dates that I have for Death of a Salesman being put on by the Palo Alto Players is January 15th through the 31st. So we've got another 10 days of performance. You're doing performances on Friday, Saturday?
We perform tonight. We're Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
I see here Thursdays at 7:30, Fridays and Saturdays at 8 p.m., and a Sunday matinee at 2 o'clock.
That's correct.
And that's the Palo Alto Players, a production of Death of a Salesman, the great play where attention must be paid by Arthur Miller. Kristen Lowe is the director and has a great cameo appearance, I expect. And also Tim Farrell plays Willie Loman. And I'm really excited to hear about this show, and thank you for putting it on. And a website to go to if you want to attend this show, what would that be? Where would people want to go to, at least on the computer?
www.paplayers.org will take you to places where you can buy tickets.
Fantastic. You know, I'm imagining the listener sitting there going, wait a second, tell me what it is. I got a pen and paper in hand. So it's paplayers.org.
Yeah.
And I see a telephone number. It's 650-329-0819. You'll get either a friendly robot or a friendly human being.
That's right.
Kristen Lowe, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you for your questions. It was a wonderful conversation.
And Tim, thank you for your work. You've worked with kids and you've taught drama all your life, and now here you are playing one of the greatest roles in American drama, Willie Loman. Tim, thank you so much for spending a little time with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Diane, speaking of things being different and things changing, you have an announcement you want to share with us, don't you?
Not yet.
Then think about that for a second, folks. Tell us.
Okay.
Tell us some good news, and then tell us the
okay,
bad news.
Okay. I'm just going to do. I know that you had Hershey Felder on last week, but I wanted to tell you from the audience's point of view what it was like, rather than from his point of view. And my point is that as from the time the lights went up until the gentle closing, we were really listening and watching Irving Berlin tell his own story. The reasons he wrote the songs that he did and how his life took place we all knew the songs when we were there, and he even asked us to sing along, which was kind of fun because they're all songs we knew. Anybody that was really young in that theater didn't understand some of the laughter that we gave, but it was really good. One of the funniest lines that he had is when he had to do something for a Hollywood studio, and the studio had told him he'd be writing for a song for a fellow who couldn't sing, he couldn't act, and he couldn't dance, and his name was Fred Astaire. And so
and the rest is history.
And the rest is history. And he also was asked to write songs for Ethel Merman, who he called a foghorn. And so I thought that was kind of great. In the best sense of the term, it was a joy of an evening. The people I've talked to that have seen it have been very, very happy. There was one thing I wanted to talk about, but I can't because I don't know how to discuss it. It was the lighting and the scenery. They were so much an important part of this, and it was so softly done that you didn't notice the changes until after they had been made, and it was a natural part of what was going on. All I can say is it's a wonderful evening at the theater, and if you love music in Irving Berlin, please go to see it. It's at Theater Works, and it's called Hershey Felder as Irving Berlin. It's going to be there till February 14th at Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts. The number is 650-463-1960. And now one more quick thing, and that's Spotlight the movie. Now, it's gotten a lot of talk, and I think it's up for a few. It should be up for a lot of awards because of the way it was done. But this is a true story. At the Boston Globe, there are four of them, writers, who form Spotlight. They pick out local stories of interest for the Boston community, and they follow them regardless of how long it takes to continue that thing. The four are played by Michael Keaton, Mark Ruffalo, Rachel McAdams, and Liev Schreiber. The movie starts in 2001 with the hint of molestation of young boys by an unfrocked priest. It comes to their attention. After a lot of discussion, they are convinced to follow the story to its conclusion while learning that many of the problems went as far back as the 70s. One after another, they find the boys, who are now men, many of whom refused to discuss what had happened for obvious reasons, didn't want their names to be used. And as they continue hunting for those young men, their list of abused boys rises to 80. Then more information comes to light. There were certain priests move from parish to parish. Why? Why did so many of them use sickness and not show up in different places? They'd be kept away from their parishes, always with the acceptance of the church hierarchy, and it shows that in the movie. This is no movie about porn. It's just the true story of men who use their positions to molest young boys and not be charged even with a misdemeanor. The story shook the church to its very roots, as it should have. Even the Pope, on his most recent visit, made a slight mention, according to what I saw. It has been suggested by the Washington Post to be the finest newspaper story in its time, with All the President's Men and Citizen Kane. And I agree with that. If you stay to see the credit rolls at the end, you will see a startling roll of cities in the United States where these molestation happens, and it goes on for two or three pages with the numbers of molestations in our cities, and then it goes to Europe, and you see all the countries there. And it's an incredible, incredible film. And I suggest that everyone see it. It's a history. It's history in the making.
Diane Keough, thank you so much for that. Will we see you again?
No, you won't.
Why?
Because I'm leaving. I'm moving. As was said earlier by someone here, that I can't afford to live here anymore.
Oh, my God.
Which I hate. I hate leaving. I hate leaving this. I've had such a good time here. And I look forward to maybe getting on an NPR show in Phoenix. I hope I'll be in a suburb there.
Write to us, would you please?
I will. I will, Kevin. It's so great to see you again.
Good to see you too, Diane.
And goodbye, everybody. I'm going to miss you.
And say hello to Peter Robinson just a moment. Here's Louis Armstrong to bring
Hi,
us
Peter.
Peter Robinson.
He's right over my shoulder.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
A Wonderful World with Peter Robinson. Peter, good to see you again. What's up?
Good. Well, good to see you, Kevin. Also, a happy birthday. It's a wonderful world for Kevin, I should tell listeners back here, in case they haven't clocked on yet. But that, of course, was the immortal voice of Louis Armstrong. And I emphasize the Louis because in that song where he sings Hello, Dolly, he then goes on to say, this is Louis Dolly. And the actual pronunciation of his name meant something to him. When you're down in New Orleans, there's two types of way of saying Louis or Louis. The Creole way is to borrow from the French, hence Louis, but the African-American way, which is what he wanted to recognize, is Louis Armstrong. And I use it as an introduction to a play which has just opened at ACT. It's called Satchmo at the Waldorf. It's written by the Wall Street Times critic, Mr. Teachout, and it deals with those minutes, two years, in fact, just before Louis Armstrong died. He's at the Waldorf. It's a scene set in the dressing room before he goes on, and in that scene, he's talking with his manager, the famous Mr. Glasser, Joe Glasser, who had managed most of his career throughout. Glasser, of course, was a friend of the mob. He got Louis Armstrong in and out of scrapes. He was a moving figure. But I think my fascination, essentially, with Louis Armstrong is how, for those first 70 years of the 20th century, he managed to embrace and give a meaning to jazz. He was both on the what I call the white and the black side of things, a controversial figure in many senses. But he really, when he picked up that horn and started blasting, all the laughter went out, the seriousness of the playing came. But to play off against that, you had that magnificent smile, and his smile absolutely lit up the whole particular house. So very quickly, the play has just opened last night at ACT. It runs until the end, second week of February, around about February the 8th. And although it's fictionalized, I think you get an understanding of that contrast between What a Wonderful World and the real world that Louis Armstrong had to cope with through the civil rights movement, through his own rich background. He played with so many different established, well-known jazz musicians himself, but he gave a real feeling and a real meaning to what that world was, and above all, what the world jazz really meant. So I thought we might go out with a song that he did. It actually came from High Society. He's singing here with Bing Crosby, of all people. We don't associate Bing Crosby immediately with New Orleans or black. And I think what it does is speak about how you can move from one shape of music to the other and still retain the world jazz. Some of the great musicians, Hoagy Carmichael, Jack Tiergarden, Teddy Wilson, Django Reinhardt, Buddy Berrigan, Gene Krupa, they all acknowledged the great eloquence of Satchmo. So here's a duet. Here's that great duet from High Society with Bing Crosby. This is jazz.
Dear gentle folk of Newport, or maybe I should say hats and caps, I want you to lend an ear because, I want you to hear some really shimmering sharps and flats. For these cozy virtuosi, just about the greatest in the trade, are fixing to show you now precisely how, or approximately, jazz music is made. Well, you take some skins, jazz begins, and you take a bass. Man, now we're getting someplace. Take a box, well, it rocks. Take a blue horn, New Orleans bar. You take a stick with a lick, take a bone, oh, hold the phone, take a spot, cool and hot. Now you have jazz, 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 little don't so.
Well, there you have it. That is jazz. And, of course, in comes Louis Armstrong giving his magic touch, the golden horn, as I always used to call it. And I think, too, if I had to choose one Louis Armstrong song, mine would still be Potato Head Blues. That is a piece of music that really takes you into the value of where the trumpet can take you. Now, by total way of contrast, way off from New Orleans, we're going back to the world of Noel Coward. And Noel Coward, in fact, is the epitome of what I call the typical Englishman. He, too, straddles the whole of the 20th century, born more or less the same time as Louis Armstrong, died almost the same time in the 1970s. And at the Sausalito Library on February the 4th, we are having a dedication to Noel Coward. We're including clips from some of the music and some of the movies that he made. Brief Encounter is, of course, one of the classics with Trevor Howard and Celia Johnson. But we're also going to include some of those cabaret songs. And when he was coming back on a cruise from Singapore on that ocean liner, one of the ladies came up to him with hopes for her daughter. And Noel Coward put into song and verse form an answer to the question, because she wanted the daughter to go on the stage. And out of nowhere, here came that tinkling piano, the magic of Noel Coward's voice, with that one immortal line, "Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington."
Mr. Irving Berlin often emphasizes sin in a charming way. Mr. Coward, we know, wrote a song or two to show sex was here to stay.
Worthington, but it turned out to be Let's Do It, but we have Don't Put Your Daughter on the Stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't Put Your Daughter on the Stage. Advice to a mother as she projects her young actress, her daughter, and these are those immortal words.
Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage. The profession is overcrowded and the struggle's pretty tough. And admitting the fact she's burning to act, that isn't quite enough. She has nice hands to give the wretched girl her due, but don't you think her bust is too developed for her age? I repeat, Mrs. Worthington, sweet Mrs. Worthington, don't put your daughter on the stage.
So that is February the 4th, 6:45 at the Sausalito Library, a special Noel Coward soiree. And if you want more information about that, I'm going to give out a number, so time to get your pen and pencil and paper out. Call 415-381-6671. That's February the 4th at the Sausalito Library, a Noel Coward soiree. And the telephone number for details and information, 415-381-6671. And of course, Let's Do It. It may be Let's Do It. This was Noel Coward's version of that old Cole Porter song with his little twist to how it goes.
Mr. Irving Berlin often emphasizes sin in a charming way. Mr. Coward, we know, wrote a song or two to show sex was here to stay. Richard Rogers, it's true, took a more romantic view of this sly biological urge, but it really was Cole who contrived to make the whole thing merge. He said the Belgians and Greeks do it. Nice young men who sell antiques do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Monkeys, whenever you look, do it. Alicante.